Our next presentation before lunch is by Jay Budziszewski, and it's a privilege to have him here with us this morning. He is going to speak on what makes men men. He is professor of government and philosophy at the University of Texas in Austin, where he also teaches courses in the law school and the religious studies department. He specializes in political philosophy, ethical philosophy, legal philosophy, and the interaction of religion with philosophy. A lot of philosophy there. Among his research interests are classical natural law, virtue ethics, conscience, and moral self-deception, the institution of the family in relation to political and social order, religion in public life, and the problem of toleration. His books include What We Can't Not Know, and also On the Meaning of Sex, which we also have copies of that, and I believe other books of his in the back. And he's currently working on a commentary on Thomas Aquinas' Virtue Ethics. Please welcome Jay Budziszewski. Thank you.
Glad to be with you today. You can't hear me, can you? Let me get over here by the microphone and then you can. I was saying that I'm really glad to be with you here today. This is an unusual sort of experience, these Touchstone conferences. I'm truly blessed that this is an ecumenical experience with Protestants, Catholics, Orthodox, and maybe some people who don't know what they are yet, but I'm very glad to be here. I couldn't help but smile in listening to Glenn Stanton's talk. I've enjoyed all the talks, including his very much. But I smiled because, given the title of his talk, Manhood is Not Natural, I thought you might listen to me and think, well, Budziszewski is giving a talk about how manhood is natural. And so I thought it might be that I should begin with a little comment. You know, sociologists and anthropologists, when they use the word natural, tend to mean the spontaneous, that which comes spontaneously to beings of our nature. And ethical philosophers and theologians tend to use the word natural to mean the mature, the flourishing, that which represents the full and appropriate development of people of our nature. So in one sense, of course, it is completely true, and I agree with Glenn, we agree about almost everything, that manhood is not natural. But I'm going to be talking about the sense in which it is, the sense in which men cannot flourish except by being a certain thing. What is it to be a man? And how can we know? You know, there are all sorts of approaches to knowing in our day. Some people say the best way to understand the nature of the human male is to consider the selection pressures which operated during his presumed rise from the apes. Well, there are two problems with this strategy, at least two. The first is that on this hypothesis, the only genes that are consistently passed on are the ones for traits that have adaptive value, right? That enable you to pass on your genes to the next generation. But obviously that isn't so. Tell me the adaptive value of seeking to know the meaning of life. It doesn't help you survive and pass on your genes. Tell me the adaptive value and the ability to be awed and humbled and transported by the music of J.S. Bach. One eminent sociobiologist, E.O. Wilson, claims, why do people believe in God? Well, they must have genes for believing in God. Why do they have genes for believing in God? They must have had adaptive value. Well, why did they have adaptive value? Because belief in God unites the social group. Well, that has always puzzled me. Why not just have genes for uniting the social group? Besides which, no one seems to have told him that believing different things about God can tear the group apart. So these things don't explain what it is to be human, or in particular, what it is to be a human male, what it is to be a man. The second problem is that even if we did develop entirely by natural selection, we don't know what selection pressures were operating. A neo-Darwinian theory can't say how human males had to come out. All it can do is observe how they did come out and then spin tales of how it might have happened. After all, the primates all came out different ways. The chimpanzee is highly aggressive and dominated by males. The bonobo is less aggressive and dominated by females, which is why radical feminists like bonobos much better than chimpanzees. And seriously, that's true. And we are neither chimpanzees nor bonobos. Thank God. Other people say that the best way to understand the nature of the human male is simply to observe him. That might be a little bit chilling sometimes, but to observe him, well, that's better, but there are problems with this approach too, if all you do is just watch. The first problem is simple variation, because not all men are the same, not all women are the same. For every generalization about either sex, there are exceptions. From this, a naive observer might conclude, well, there's no such thing as male and female nature, right? But this is a mistake. The fact that most women are more nurturing than most men is not an accident. There are exceptions, of course, but nevertheless, it's not an accident. It arises from a genuine difference in the essence, the underlying reality, the difference between manhood and womanhood as such. The difference is so powerful that men and women are influenced by this difference even when they seem to defy it. For example, we say women are more nurturing. And yet, isn't it true? We know that some young women conceal their pregnancies, give birth in secret, and then do away with the babies. Well, nothing more opposed to nurturance could be imagined. But wait. Let's consider the ways that these young women do away with their babies. Do they cut their throats? Do they plunge knives into them? No, how often they place them in trash cans and dumpsters still alive. That is more typical. Why don't they just kill him? That's what a man usually does if he wants to do away with a child. Well, perhaps a young woman imagines her baby resting in the dumpster, quietly and painlessly slipping into a death that is, perhaps she imagines something like sleep. Or perhaps she imagines a fairy tale ending in which some other woman finds her baby in the dumpster and brings him up as her own. The act is not nurturing. But even so, the inclination to nature has not precisely been destroyed. It has been perverted under the influence of other strong motives. I dare say that data like this are not captured by our psychological instruments, by our surveys, by our Rorschach blots. It's not enough to count things. One must see with the eyes of the heart. Now, the second problem with the just observe strategy is that it can't tell us the difference between how we are meant to be and how we are. For example, some observers say, I've read this, by nature, human males are pretty nearly but not quite monogamous. They say the chimpanzees are, by nature, are very promiscuous. We're not quite monogamous. Most men like the idea of having a mate, but many men wander. Well, now, it may be true in a statistical sense that large numbers of men lapse from monogamy. We know that. It's also true, though, isn't it, in a statistical sense, that most people are sick some of the time? Would you say it's natural for us to be sick some of the time? No. You would say, by nature, you wouldn't say by nature human beings are sick some of the time. What you say is nature intends us to be healthy. That is what it means for us to flourish. But sometimes we lapse from nature's intention. Why then don't we say that nature intended men to be monogamous, but that sometimes they lapse from this intention too, that their flourishing requires this? But they don't always do what is good for them. Sometimes our desires may oppose the even deeper things that are built into our hearts. It's as though a physician who saw only broken arms assumed that if arms have no fractures, there must be something wrong with them. Well, how could we correct such a misguided physician? I think that we would correct him by calling attention to the purpose or the function of the arms. What are they for? What is their proper work? Broken arms cannot do their proper work as well as intact arms. Therefore, brokenness is not their natural state. Even if every human being you saw had a broken arm, you can infer from what the work of the arm is that all of these arms you were seeing were deviated from their natural state. The nature of a thing is not determined by how something happens to be, but by what it is for, by what it is designed to do, what it is designed to become if everything goes well, by how it flourishes. Well, very well then. What are men and women for? In one respect, they are for the same thing, being rational. They are for the knowledge of the truth, especially the truth about God. And for that love, modeled by his love, of which only rational beings are capable. But there is a difference. A man is a rational being of that sex whose members are potentially fathers. A woman is a rational being of that sex whose members are potentially mothers. Now, the idea of potentiality needs explanation. This tends to be misunderstood in our day, too, because people think that it's the same thing as physical possibility. People would say, well, a eunuch is not doesn't have the potential for fatherhood. Well, he no longer has the physical possibility of becoming a father. But the what it is more proper to say that because he is a man, this potentiality is embedded in his nature, but it has been thwarted. There is some impediment. So although a person who is infertile because of some disease, it may not be physically possible for him to be a father, we should not say that he lacks the potentiality for fatherhood. As a man, he has that potentiality, but the disease has blocked its realization. And it is just because he is a man, just because he is endowed with this potentiality for fatherhood, that the block to its physical realization is such an occasion for sorrow. Now, I think the block to the physical possibility of the potentiality for motherhood is more readily available to the intuition of a woman. She grieves if she is infertile. Men sometimes take a while to figure it out. There are a lot of things about themselves that men find it harder to grasp, but eventually, sometimes with the help of women, they can get it. They can get it. Another reason why the expression potentiality for fatherhood requires explanation is this: although siring children is the most characteristic expression of fatherhood, it is far from being its only expression. A man, as we all know, may sire a child yet fail in the greater perspective of fatherhood because he fails to protect the mother, or because he fails to protect the child, or because he fails to give the child that father's love which only he can give, because it is different than a mother's love. We can carry this line of reasoning still further. A potentiality is something like a calling. It is something like a vocation. It wants, so to speak, to develop. It demands, so to speak, a response. It's like an arrow notched in the string and aimed at the target, even if it is never released, never takes flight. It intimates an inbuilt meaning and expresses an inbuilt purpose which cannot help but influence the mind and will of every person imbued with it. Alice von Hildebrand, who has written primarily about motherhood rather than fatherhood, has remarked that although not every woman is called to marry and bear physical children, yet she says, and I quote, every woman, whether married or unmarried, is called upon to be a biological or psychological or spiritual mother. Now, I think that's true, and I'm saying that for men, the reality is parallel. Not every man is called to marry and bear physical children, and there is such a thing as consecrated celibacy, but every man, whether married or unmarried, is called upon to be a biological, psychological, or spiritual father. Now, obviously, I can't speak from inside of experience of womanhood because I'm a man. Yet even a man can see that it's a very different thing to be a woman than to be a man. A man may deeply love his child. I heard some words about that from Leon Poddles, and my heart resonated. I remember holding my own children, looking into their faces, and being amazed at that it was even possible to feel something like this. A man may deeply love his child, but he doesn't have a womb with which to carry the child in his body for 9 months, or milk with which to nourish the child at his own breasts. These experiences connect the mother with her child in an intimate physical bond, which we men can easily recognize, but which we cannot experience. And in subtle ways, they condition her emotional responses, not only to the child, but toward herself, and even toward everyone else. They also make sense of certain other differences between men and women. Differences not just between raw, undeveloped men and women, as our first speaker spoke of so eloquently, but differences between men and women, even at their best, when they are fully and appropriately developed. And differences for which each sex is sometimes criticized. For example, are women in general more protective of their bodies than men? Well, yes. Are men less careful about their bodily safety than women? Obviously so. Last week, at least three times on campus, I saw young men on skateboards doing silly things and almost breaking their skulls. Women who carry children, though, need to be more protective of their bodies just because of that potentiality. Men, in order to protect them, need to be less careful about their safety for the same reason. It isn't that men, by being men, are more virtuous, for instance, more courageous, or that women, by being women, are more virtuous, as some people will say. Some writers, you notice, talk as though men are fallen, but women aren't. No, we're both fallen. Neither one of us is more virtuous than the other, but their most typical temptations are different. The most typical temptations of a man are different than the most typical temptations of a woman. The ways in which they lapse from virtue are likely to be somewhat different, and although they can have all the same virtues, their virtues have different inflections. A masculine and feminine inflection of courage, a masculine and feminine inflection of temperance, and so forth. The other sexual differences make sense in this light, too. As Edith Stein reminds us, men are more prone to abstraction. People say that's a cliche, that's a stereotype. Well, there's a reason sometimes why stereotypes become current. It's because they're true. Men are more prone to abstraction, and women are more prone to focus on the concrete. Men don't mind what is impersonal, but women are more attuned to the nuances of relationships. A man tends to be a specialist and a single tasker. He tends to develop certain qualities to an unusually high pitch, using them to do things in the world. A woman tends to be a generalist and a multitasker. She inclines to a more rounded development of her abilities, Stein tells us, using them to nurture the life around her. The woman's potentiality for motherhood explains this. It ties all of these qualities of hers together. It makes sense of her contrast with men. Consider just that multitasking capacity. In view of what it takes to run a home, doesn't it make sense for her to be like that? A woman has to be a center of peace for her family, even though 100 things are happening at once. But a man is designed more for the protection of the hearth and the people who surround it. He's not so perfectly specialized for their nurture. Now, when I speak of the hearth, it may sound as though I'm saying that women should never leave the kitchen. I'm not saying anything like that at all. Although men do tend to gravitate to careers and women to motherhood, not all women will pursue an exclusively domestic life, even though the potentiality for motherhood explains why women who do pursue a career and who have free choice of career tend to choose careers that allow them to give first place to caring for their children. It also explains why they tend to choose careers that give greater scope to maternal qualities. In fact, even when a well-balanced woman does choose a traditionally masculine career, which sometimes happens, she also tends to perform it in ways that give scope to maternal qualities, although a man might not. A male lawyer, for instance, tends to focus on the properties of the task itself and on the rules. Well, this is worthy. But it's all too easy for him to lose sight of the humanity of his clients. Can he learn to remember their humanity? Well, of course he can. But he's more likely to need the reminder in the first place. And it's usually from women that he gets it. A female lawyer may find the abstract quality of the law somewhat alienating, more so perhaps than he does, even though it's necessary. On the other hand, she's much less likely to forget that she is dealing with human beings. You know, I find that it's much more difficult to speak about fatherhood than motherhood. Now, maybe some of those reasons are in the nature of the thing. I commented on the way that motherhood is mediated by the physical relationship of the woman to the child, which is more remote for the man. But I think that that may be one of the reasons, or perhaps because in our day, paternal absenteeism and other forms of masculine failure are so conspicuous. And so most of us have a dimmer idea of fatherhood than motherhood. Several of our speakers have commented that open mockery of fathers has become a fixture of popular culture. The father is just a figure of scorn. The difference between fatherhood and motherhood, though, is real. It is concrete. It's one of those things built into us, and we need to understand it. You know, I think one thing that we need to talk about is that the difference between fatherhood and motherhood, and hence between manhood and womanhood, involves a difference in the male and female, the characteristic male and female modes of love for their children. It's difficult to describe this difference, because the two have so much in common just by being love. But there is a lot to this. This isn't the only difference, of course. Manhood in general, for instance, is outward directed. Womanhood in general is inward directed. This is no cliche. The distinction is actually quite subtle. Outward directedness, for instance, is not the same thing as other directedness. For many men prefer to deal not with other people but with things. Inward directedness is not the same as self-directedness, for what John Paul II called the genius of woman includes caring for the local circle. That's inward in a sense. It's looking inward to the circle, but that's not a focus on herself. If the difference between inward and outward directedness sounds like a dig at, for instance, male sexual promiscuity, or a jibe at so-called female narcissism or emotional dependency, well, it isn't that either. There are such characteristics. Sexual promiscuity is obviously far more widespread among men. A certain kind of emotional dependency seems to be far more widespread among women. But I'm not making a dig against that either. Characteristics of these sorts are not the essence of the difference between manhood and womanhood. They are merely vices that result from the indulgence of temptations to which the two sexes are not equally susceptible. And in speaking of outward and inward directedness, my intention is not to call attention to the corruptions, but to the good things that sometimes do get corrupted. It's a good thing that an unmarried man pursues the beloved, although you can see how that could be corrupted into promiscuity. It is a good thing that the unmarried woman makes herself attractive to pursuit. You could see how this could be corrupted to vanity. It is a good thing that a husband protects the home, whereas the wife establishes it on the hearth. It is a good thing that the father represents the family and oversees it. As C.S. Lewis once put, he's in charge of the foreign relations of the family. Whereas a mother conducts the family and manages it. Well, now that brings us to one more thing. The directive geniuses of the father and the mother are not the same. And this is about men and women, too. They are not the same, and yet both of them truly rule the home. They're not equal in the sense of being the same. They are equal in the sense of being equally worthy of respect and complementary to each other, equally made in the image of God, but they don't have the same function. We may compare the father with a king reigning over a commonwealth, perhaps, and the mother with a queen. These are potent archetypes, as I've remarked before, though. Why are they so potent? Because they reflect something really about reality. They aren't just stereotypes. The king and the queen image express different inflections of glory and nobility and self-command. You know, men joke about their wives telling them what to do. The joke would have no point unless two things were true. On the one hand, they would not want their wives to be kings, but on the other hand, they know they are really queens. We sometimes say that mothers and fathers share and divide the different aspects of sovereignty between themselves in something like, I've heard this, I think it's true, in something like the same way that the directive functions are divided in corporations. Is this a new idea? Actually, it's a very old idea. In one of the letters of St. Paul to Timothy, we find him using a curious pair of words. He uses a verb, proistemi, for what a husband characteristically does. And he uses a noun, oikodespates, for what a woman characteristically is. Now, both of these words indicate authority, but with a difference. The term used for the husband has a range of meanings that include standing before, presiding, superintending, protecting, maintaining, helping, succoring, acting in the capacity of a patron. Very much like a chairman of the board, I guess. But the term used for the woman means the ruler of the house. Really, oikodespotes means the despot of the house. She's the house despot. Very much like a chief executive officer. I think this idea is really very ancient. When all goes well, fathers and mothers also exemplify and specialize in different aspects of wisdom. I commented on them having different inflections of the virtues. Well, let's talk about the characteristic inflections of wisdom. A wise father teaches his wife and his family that in order to love, you must be strong. But a wise mother teaches her husband and her family that in order to be strong, you must love. That's a hard lesson for men, but it's an absolutely essential lesson for them and for their well-being. She knows that even boldness needs humility. On the other hand, he also has something to teach because he knows that even humility needs to be bold. He is an animate symbol, a living emblem to his children of that justice which is tempered by mercy. She is a living emblem of that mercy which is tempered by justice. A wise father knows when to say, ask your mother, and a wise mother knows when to say, ask your father. And when they do this, they're not passing the buck. Well, they could be. But it's not necessarily. When they do this, they are sharing sovereignty. Each of them refracts like white light going through a prism and coming out in all different colors. Each of them refracts a different hue from the glowing light of royalty. Today it's almost embarrassing to hear things like I've been saying. Some of you may be cringing. I mean, come on, kings and queens and royalty and refracting different light. Comparisons of mothers and fathers with kings and queens seems naive to us, nostalgic, sentimental, exaggerated. They make us squirm. There are strong reasons for this reaction, but they're bad ones. How many parents have lost their regal dignity today? How many parents have disbelieved in their own authority and confused the proper humility of their office with being self-mocking and ironic? We've turned husbands and wives into androgynous spouses, fathers and mothers into interchangeable parent figures. We've turned children into lifestyle enhancements. We approach having a child like acquiring a pool table or a widescreen television. Would it be fun? Would it be tedious? Would it be worth the expense? And we don't think of it in terms of vocation. Fathers and mothers have need of recovering their sense of regal calling, taking up their ball and scepter, and ruling their dominions with love for their precious subjects. It's not for nothing that the king of a commonwealth is called sire. Humanly speaking, of the callings of fatherhood and kingship, the deeper and more primordial of those two is fatherhood. May it be needless to say that mothers and fathers must also recover the conviction of their need for each other. Neither of them can flourish, neither of them can thrive without each other. This is true even of people who live consecrated religious lives. To say, I will abstain from sexual intercourse, I will abstain from marriage, I will not make a household with a woman, with a man, is not the same as to say, I am independent of the other sex. We are always complementary to the other sex and need each other's presence in the world. As one writer has said, there is more color in the world because there are two sexes. There is more music in the world. There is more humor, even in the fact that we may sometimes find each other ridiculous. We have to recover the conviction of our need for each other, not only for our own sakes, but for the sake of our young. Every child needs both kinds of love. It's not enough to provide an intermediate love that's half motherly and half fatherly, or an inconsistent love that's motherly at some times and fatherly at other times, nor is it enough to give one kind of love for real while giving only a pretense or a simulacrum of the other kind. And you know, even though the two loves resemble each other, simply by being love, they are distinct, and neither can be imitated by anything else. It's true that it may be real heroism when, for example, a mother or a father, through no fault of his own or her own, has to raise a child all alone. That is sometimes heroic, yet it's better not to be alone. And there's no heroism if this was done by choice. No woman can fully take the place of a father. No man can fully take the place of a mother. These differences reach even further. For men, you know, this has been intimated today, growing up is like joining a brotherhood. Today, our grasp of this fact is attenuated by the fact that we've lost our rites and customs of apprenticeship and of coming of age. Yet men naturally desire to be something like, I'll be even cornier, like knights, who not only do hard things, but who in firm and fatherly manner train squires who attend them so that these young men can learn to do hard things too. As I was in earnest before, when I spoke about the calling of all men to extended fatherhood, so I'm in earnest now about the chivalric element in this calling. I don't think it's corny. I think it's just the truth. A man will more readily aspire to manhood if he can taste it His life has to have the flavor of valor. We will never make it attractive to him if he can't detect that flavor. This is going to be true of how he carries himself, not only toward other men, but toward women. The fashion of the day is to think of medieval knights, you know, not as valiant, but as cruel. We break down everything. Well, many of the medieval knights, of course, were cruel. Yet, even in that day, knighthood was more than a veneer for oppression. It was a great and noble ideal that did a great deal to civilize a society that was still governed by a warrior caste and too often running with blood. Like the members of our own ruling class, as different as it is, the members of that caste sometimes fought for the wrong things. They sometimes fought in the wrong ways. They sometimes committed atrocities. All such perversion should be condemned. But don't let us abuse the members of that caste just because they liked to fight. Are there not plenty of things to fight about in this world? Plenty of evils to oppose? Don't we even speak of the church militant? After all, most men don't like simply to fight. They're too lazy for that. They like to fight when there is something worth fighting for, something that gets up their blood. True, they sometimes make up things worth fighting for just to be able to fight for them. And it's true that one of the tasks of becoming a man is learning to resist that temptation and to identify what the real things worth fighting for are and the real ways of fighting for them. There are plenty of noble things to fight for without making them up. A woman may resist temptation, you know, but a man thinks of making war against temptation. He thinks of it differently. A woman may seek to reside in the citadel of virtue, but a man thinks of capturing for himself the citadel of virtue. In the same martial spirit, a virtuous man desires to contend for just wars, to defend and to protect sound traditions, to attack lies and fallacies with the weapons of frankness and reason, and yes, even to make gentle war for courtesy. By the way, if it's right at times to fight, then it's also right in some ways to enjoy fighting. Even though it's also right to grieve the evils that are incidental to the struggle and to try to minimize them. A certain militancy and a certain vigilance are an essential part of manhood. And a man's great project is not to do away with his impulse to fight, but to learn to fight generously and nobly, to refine that raw ore, to burn away its dross, to make it into purified steel. And this is an ideal to which any man may aspire. Very few of us will wear greaves and carry physical swords and ride on horses, but this ideal is independent of what we do for a living or what we ride upon, how much education that we've had, or whether we are muscular and athletic or not. Medieval knights engage their enemies physically. There's always some need for that. That's why we have armies and police. Yet there are many ways to fight besides the physical. One may fight through a word in season, through a clap on the shoulder, a quiet admonishment or commendation. One may wage war by bearing witness, by lifting the fallen, by refusing to countenance evil. One may do battle by admonishing idlers, by encouraging the faint-hearted, by helping the weak. All this makes the achievement of manhood hard work. Hard work. How Glenn Stanton was right about that. It is labor that requires a firm hand with the desires and devices of the heart. The best instance of a human male is not a glorified walking packet of urges, but a man who, for the sake of the highest and greatest goods, commands himself, strengthens his brothers, defends his sisters, and regards even the meanest of women as a lady. You may say that this is not natural. Of course, it isn't natural in the sense of the spontaneous. That was correctly said earlier. But in another way it is. I say it is natural in the sense that only in this way does a being of this nature flourish. Once upon a time, the differences between men and women were not thought so strange, were not thought so scandalous, did not make us cringe. We have a long quest and a difficult journey before we can speak of them again with ease and even with gaiety. There are so many sweet and lovely things that our ears can no longer hear without odium. So many blameless things that can hardly be discussed without scandal. Just imagine the din, the fury, the ruckus that would erupt in the world if I were to praise and extol that great activity that comes so much more readily to the woman and is slandered under the false name of being passive. Be it unto me as you have said. And if I were to compound the offense by pointing out that every last one of us, both man and woman, is feminine with respect to God, well, there would be an earthquake. The journey back to the commonwealth of sense will be long and difficult, and we'll meet trolls and enchanters along the twisted way, and I say, laugh at them. They will obstruct our passage, they will demand tribute, they will try to lure us into byways and bogs. But you know, since we can't become any more begrimed and muddy and bewitched than we already are in our day in these confused times, why should that discourage us? Let us slog along on that path, a smile on our lips, a song in our throats, a sword in our hands, and a prayer in our hearts. We may as well fight with good cheer. And I thank you.
So we have about 10 minutes for some Q&A. I'd also ask Glenn Stanton if you, because we had no time for your Q&A also. If you'd like to come up and take a seat, we'll get another microphone from the back that you can use. But let's take a question here for you, Jay, if you want to sit.
Oh, I should sit? Okay.
Or you can stand there, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I'm actually a pacer. I'm more comfortable standing.
Well,
okay.
Yes, I'd like to ask, what are the historical or philosophical origins of the kind of egalitarianism that...
I'm sorry, I thought that was a stanchion holding up the roof. I meant no disrespect to the cross. Yeah. Please go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. The philosophical and historical antecedents of the sort of...
Of the sort of egalitarianism that is at war with masculinity and femininity nowadays.
Well, you know, misunderstandings of equality have gone back for centuries and centuries and centuries. They've been at times widespread in popular culture, even in political culture. Aristotle, for instance, commented on a misunderstanding of equality that can take place in the best regime. He thought that citizens should be able to be both to rule and to be ruled. Before the law, they were equal. But this can be misunderstood, and you can think that everything is the same, that everything is the same, and he thought that that was a gross error. The wrong kind of equality means the obliteration of distinctions of all kinds. The right kind of equality is to say that people should be treated the same in the respects in which they are the same. You know, it's not a denigration to a child to say we don't let you drink alcohol. It's not a denigration to the citizen to say you are not the legislator, although you could be, you know, elected as one. It's not a denigration to the to either men or to women to say that they're not the same. But we lose sight of distinctions, and always in losing sight of them, there is some personal motive. There is something which makes the losing sight of that distinction attractive to us, either because it's an opportunity for laziness, or for oppression, or for some other thing that benefits us in some selfish and personal way.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a question here, please.
Professor Budashevsky.
Okay. Yes, sir.
So many distinguished speakers here, but I'm here today because of you. And the reason I'm here because of you is I've carried something around with me for 20 years. I've never heard you speak, and it's been a delight for me. But I want to show you, it's old and wrinkled like I am. This is what I've carried around, a 1998 issue of First Things magazine with a title article by you, The Revenge of Conscience. Conscience not only restrains us, but it digs us into deeper holes by causing us, you can tell the story better than me. My one question for you is, you begin this article from 20 years ago. Things are getting worse very quickly now. Sir, they've only gotten far, far worse.
Yeah, I'm afraid
so.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. They are getting worse very quickly, and it's an interesting question. You're right. I began that article by saying things are worse, getting worse very quickly now, and I gave some examples. I ended that article in saying they can't get worse forever. They can't get worse forever. If a society should crumble, there is going to be another society that takes its place. We speak sometimes of the pendulum. The thing that we have to understand when we're thinking of the pendulum is not that things automatically go this way and then go this way and then go this way. It's rather that we can do things, and we are today. We can do things to try to artificially prevent the swing from coming back. We're going up to an extreme, and we may not want the pendulum to come down to the central point of balance, and so we hold it up there. We hold it up there. And we'll even invent social and even medical technologies to do this, like artificial contraceptives. Okay, like contraceptives, but eventually the weight of it becomes too strong. Even our attempt to outwit the natural consequences of our deeds itself has natural consequences, and the pendulum slips from our hands. And when it comes down with much more explosive and destructive force. So I am concerned that could happen. I hope it won't happen, and it's one of the reasons for this kind of a conference. So that we can either leaven this culture and prevent that from happening, or if we go down in flames, that perhaps we will lay some seeds so that the one that succeeds us, with the help of the church, will do better. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. For Glenn Stanton, please. Thank you for your presentation and for correctly underscoring the burden of performance that rests upon men. In your comments, though, I found your presentation of women a little too positive. In a contraceptive culture, women are freer to pursue the galloping promiscuity of men, and I don't find their virtue as high as your presentation would imply. Further, tied to that, you spoke very often of the authority that women have in civilizing men, and you presented men as solely having responsibility. I have been in positions of responsibility without authority, and it's burdensome. And if you give all authority to women and all of the responsibility to men, I don't think this makes an attractive presentation for young men to take up the burdens of manhood. I'd like you to speak to that, if you would, please.
You know, that's very, very good. And it's interesting that, you know, the more positive picture of women, I find myself doing that. One, because I believe it, but still agree with you. I think the other is... And this is not positive, but it's sort of many of us in the work that we do, we get caricatured as anti-woman, so that sometimes I may default in that direction. But at the same time, from a theological perspective, I was noting to professor last night who gave us the wonderful talk on in art and literature that in the center of the Sistine Chapel, that painting right there, that adorned place, is not the creation of Adam, but it's the creation of Eve. That in the Christian story, women play a very significant role. And I might say, can we go overboard in the Christian story in praising men? No, we cannot. They bear the image of God in a unique way as men. Can we go overboard in praising women in the Christian story? No, we cannot, for the very same reason. So a bit of it might be, on some days we may find ourselves praising and lifting up women more than men. On other days, we may do that more with men than we do particularly women. But I think it's important for us to provide that sort of back and forth. And maybe Lee's talk and my talk balance each other out a little bit in that. But even as you say that, I do recognize that very much. And then the responsibility of men, I think in many ways men have to intentionally take that up. And in many ways, it's mothers and wives who push men in that direction. Go, 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 do what you need to do. But it's also fathers as well who do that. And the mother and father, men and women, do it in very different ways. I think in a general sense, what I like to say is women can push men in that direction. Men need to invite young boys in that direction, pull themselves to it.
We have just 2 minutes, so we'll take one quick question, hopefully, and direct it to.
Okay, the question is on the term extended adolescence, around the concept of extended adolescence, which I could say everything you've talked about all morning, all the speakers have to deal with that, especially for boys becoming men. But with many boys extending their adolescence to age 35, sometimes said, well, they'll still catch up, life is longer, you know, they won't have so many divorces if they wait till they're 35. But there's many, some of it's because of technology and what's possible now compared to earlier generations. No one so far has mentioned the epidemic of pornography, which I think has a dramatic effect on boys, just read recently, as young as 12. Can you say anything about, other than everything I've said this morning, what are the dilemmas of that concept of extended adolescence?
Well, I guess we have 2 minutes. I'll try to leave part
you
of
take
the...
Take two of them.
All right. you just offered me the temptation. My wife says you should never offer me. Never tell him that he can speak as long as he wants. It's a disaster. That's like a heroin addiction for a university professor. No, I'm not sure how to respond other than to say that I agree with you. The extended adolescence, it isn't even adolescence. Adolescence, in one sense, is normal to the human being. There's a transition between childhood and adulthood. In another sense, it's a sort of a cultural pathology. It's this extended sort of period of time when you're not really a kid and you're not, but you aren't given adult responsibilities. Adolescence used to be a period when you were learning to take on adult responsibilities, and it was pretty brief. And you wanted it to be over. You wanted to go on to seize your responsibilities. You wanted to grow up. You wanted to be a husband, to be a worker, to be a father. You wanted to be able to do this, and now. The strange and terrifying thing is that so many of our young men look at responsibility, and instead of thinking of it as a prize, I want to carry those responsibilities, they think of it as something to be avoided. This is the Peter Pan syndrome. I was, you know, I just never want to grow up. I was speaking to a man in an airport waiting room, you know, beside the gate one day, and we were just chatting. And he said, well, what did he say he was, 40 something, I think he was about 40. He said, I'm 40, I've got children of my own, but I still, teenagers of my own, but I still don't feel like a grown-up, he said. And he thought that this would just be a normal observation, it was shocking. It was an admission of failure and pathology. And I thought, why wouldn't he? The chief reason he wasn't growing up is because he didn't want to grow up. Well, he was just having too much fun. And yet, he was saying this, it was a kind of a confession. Was he fulfilled this way? No. This is an unnatural thing for us. We need work, we need labor, we need responsibility. We need the sacrifices, for instance, of getting married and laying yourself down for your wife, of being parents and laying yourself down for our children. We need to be awakened in the middle of the night and have to change diapers over and over and have our egoism shattered. We need all of this. But it's now in a hedonistic culture being advertised as, and of course pornography makes that worse, but so do a thousand other things, is an entertainment culture. It's not a work culture. It's not a responsibility culture. It's a play culture. And so the very things which we need the most, we look upon as a kind of a poison.
No, I think that gets it. The other thing with the pornography is, and women will tell you this, is young boys, if they even know how to interact with a woman, it's a pixelated physical image. You know, I asked my daughter at college one day, I went down to visit her, and she's just, all my daughters are the cutest little things, but she's particularly beautiful, and I said, Sophie, how many times have you been approached by guys this semester to be asked out? Not one. And it's not because she's not interesting, it's because the guys don't know how to actually approach a woman. They become desexualized, if you will, in that larger sense of the world through that porn culture. And it's not just the porn itself that is a great pathology, but what it does to the male and then the consequences for the female there. And then also it turns them not just reticent, but also into sexual consumers. You hear this from young women all the time. I'm supposed to perform like what they see. And that's not even natural and real, and certainly not respectful of the woman. So it's, again, either that absolute aggressive consumer or that very passive individual who doesn't even know how to step up and address.
Well, let's thank our presenters.